Lord, I ask that you be with us tonight. I ask that you give me clarity of thought and clear tongue so that this would speak to all of us in terms of our lives and what it means to discover God's will for our lives. And I ask that you would bless this and empower this by your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen. We have been gone now for 3 or 4 weeks. We are at the point in Genesis chapter 32, verses 9 through 32, basically, is what we're going to talk about tonight. But I'm going to cover the road so far that we've talked about in terms of Jacob, where he comes from and all that. He has been away from home for about 20 years, and we're in that process right here of him getting ready to go home. And I want to read to you chapter 32, verses 1 to 8, which kind of sets up tonight's particular study. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. We talked about that, and if you don't know, go out and get the CD off the wall. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's army." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now, and I have oxen, asses, flocks, men servants, and maid servants, and I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and he's bringing 400 men with him." That would get my attention, and I'll go through that in just a minute. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and well, he should be. And he divided the people that were with him and the flocks and the herds and camels into two companies, thinking if Esau comes to the one company and destroys it, then the company which is left will escape. What we're looking at here is a man in midlife, as far as I can see, who God is dealing with. And he's probably 75, 80 years old. Regulation, if you look at it from a biblical standpoint, but he's going to live to be about 160 years old, so he's in midlife. And one of the things I've always kind of looked at these people, if you look at them, their ages are about double ours, a lot of them. And so when I look at them, I always think of them in terms of our length of life. Now, he's probably, if you were to look at him from our standpoint, in the area of about 40 years old or a little bit older than that. And but he's 75 or so in this. But he's going to live to 175. Now, I know that some of you are past midlife because I don't think you're going to live past 100. So therefore, if you're under 50. Anyway, so he's in midlife as far as I'm concerned with this story. Jacob's story up to this point. First off, there are 9 things I got to bring up here. He stole his brother's birthright. He actually bargained it away when he gave him that chili for lunch. He then stole the blessing of his father Isaac from Esau as well. The third thing is there's always been bad blood between these brothers because of parental problems that one parent favored Jacob and one parent favored Esau. So you got that's going on this. Mom favors Jacob. Dad favors Esau. Also, then we saw him when he met God at Bethel. And he became a God's man at that point. God became real to him at that point to a certain extent. Now, if you remember that, I equate that to being born again. At that point, there was a relationship that was established between Jacob and God when God came down and made a bunch of promises and thoughts to him in terms of how he's going to be with him while he is away from home here, back here, and that he will bring him back safe. And he talked to God there, and God talked to him. Then you have, he's single, and I always think of him as being about 20, although he was about 40 years old in reality, but he was single and he falls in love with Rachel, one of his uncle's daughters, and he works for his uncle for 7 years in order to earn the ability to marry Rachel, and he makes that deal so that he'll work for 7 years. Then on the night of their wedding, I am sure that Laban tricked him and got him drunk, and he ends up with Rachel's sister Leah, and he wakes up with her in the morning. Then he ends up working for another 7 years. He gets Rachel a week later, but he works for another 7 years for the two wives. Another 6 years pass between that time and really at this point in time when he runs from Laban. He's going home. We know that. We've gone through this stuff in the fall. He has 11 children. All of them are no more than first grade. So we're talking lots of babies and diapers and crawlers and young kids. He's going home to face his own personal demons. And those personal demons have to do with his brother Esau, who he has cheated, and he bargained him out of his birthright and all that kind of stuff. One of the things that we looked at is, in terms of why he's going home, is because of affliction. He's had enough of Laban and his mistreatment as his boss and his father-in-law, and he gets all the girls, and they say, we're going to go, and so affliction is driving them. Now, I talked about affliction 3 or 4 weeks ago. Affliction isn't necessarily bad. Affliction is good because it makes you uncomfortable. But what's important here is that he was told by God, go home. Now, it's one thing to run away from things, but it is better if you're suffering from affliction and things and something's driving you on you, to wait for God to tell you where or how you're supposed to go in terms of that. And so he looked at those kinds of things. The affliction drove him, but God told him where to go, and he's supposed to go home. That brings us to verses 9 to 12, which is a prayer. And I want to walk through this prayer with you that Jacob has with God here. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who did say to me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness which thou hast shown to thy servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and slay us all, the mothers with the children. But thou didst say, I will do you good, and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Now, this prayer is really interesting. And in reality, we have a tendency to pray this kind of prayer ourselves in something. First off, he acknowledges God. He says, you're the God of my grandfather, you're the God of my father, and you talk to me. He does not say, you're my God. Did you hear that? You need to hear this. One of the things that I know about my own family and my own kids, it is one thing for me to be in relationship with God and to know him and to walk with Jesus personally myself, but I cannot do it for my kids. They have to meet Jesus themselves. And, you know, my son might say, I know you're the God of my dad and you're the God of my grandfather. I know this, but maybe that relationship's not real yet. And one of the things you need to recognize here, that for Jacob, even though God has promised things and talked to him and made his presence known to him, there's still this part of him. I would say he's born again, but that relationship is one in which he's really walking with God. It's just one of those things where he says, okay, I'm your man, or at least I might be your man, or something like that. But there's no real strong relationship here. So he acknowledges God, the gods of his dad and the gods of his grandfather, but really not him here. He also reminds God of what he talked to him about back in Bethel 20 years earlier when he appeared to him and he said, I'm going to be with you when you're gone from home and I will bring you back here safe. And he reminds God of promises and commitments that God made to him. I don't know if you've ever done that, but I said, God, as far as I know, I think you told me you're going to be with me and take care of me. And I don't know if any of you've ever done that, but I sure have, where I may be in a high-stress situation, and Jacob's in a high-stress situation. Because the last time he knew his brother was going to kill him. So he's reminding God, and he's talking about that. Also in this prayer, you notice that he acknowledges his humble beginnings. He says, all I did when I came here, all I had was my staff. I didn't have anything. And I know that you've been blessing me while I was over there, because he kept giving him good inside information as to what kind of sheep to have and goats to have and all that stuff and everything. Even though there was a lot of travail and trouble and tribulation that went through those 20 years with all those women and all those kids and dealing with his uncle, he still was blessed. And so was it good times or was it bad times? Yeah, well, it was. It's kind of like our lives. You know, good things happen, bad things happen, and things go on. But he's coming to God here right now because he's in a high-stress situation where he doesn't know what the future holds for his life, if there is a life at all, and he doesn't know whether Esau is going to come out there to kill him because he's coming with 400 men. And so he says, I have all this, but it could all come crashing down right now. And so that's what he does. He says, deliver me, because he's fearing family reprisals. That's exactly what's going on here. Okay, so that's the prayer. Anybody ever had a high-stress prayer? This is when things are going really crummy, and you don't even know if you're going to survive all that stuff. And yet here you see it. So maybe you've had one of those prayers. And if you haven't had them yet, life does go on. So here we are. So, and by the way, the thing about Jacob is he has not read his story. He doesn't know. You always got to keep that in mind. I mean, we know the rest of the story, so to speak, because we've read it. But he doesn't know the rest of the story, and neither do you know your story. On this side, anyway. So that's where we are. And so that prayer takes place. Now, verses 13 to 20, I'm going to read these things. And this is what Jacob does, you know. And don't we do this too? When we're in difficult situations, we try everything we can think of to do in order to maybe save our derrieres. So he lodged there that night, and he took from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. Said, maybe I can buy this guy off. 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milch camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 he-asses. These he delivered into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between drove and drove. This is what he's saying here is, he says, don't give it to him all at once. Okay? Says, this is kind of like Christmas. We want to give him one present at a time. So that's what he's doing. He instructed the foremost, when Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, to whom do you belong, where are you going, and whose are these before you, then you shall say, they belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau, and moreover, he is behind us. He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves, you shall say the same thing to Esau when you meet him. And you shall say, moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he thought, I may appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterwards I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him, and he himself lodged that night in the camp. And basically, he's got these gifts that he's given. He said, don't give it to him all at once. Just kind of let him kind of dribble into him so that maybe he'll just kind of ponder this stuff. You know, you don't want to give it to him all at once. That's one thing. And then he provides also escape routes for his people. He divides them basically into two or three groups in here. So he's got them separated. He's trying to salvage possibilities. That's what he's doing, and that's what's going on here. Now, here is the human stuff that he's doing. Got it? Don't we do all the human things too? You know, okay, Lord, take care of me, but we're out there, and we're digging around, and we're doing all we can to cover our derrieres. And that's what he's doing. Which brings me to the main event, so to speak. Because we do all these things, but here comes the main event. I'm going to read verses 22 to 32, and that's going to be our story part for the night. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. And remember these next five words. And Jacob was left alone. That's where we left it 3 or 4 weeks ago when we came out here. And Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and Jacob's thigh was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day is breaking. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And then he said, your name shall no more be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, tell me, I pray, your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, for I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his thigh. Therefore to this day all the Israelites do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is upon the hollow of the thigh, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh on the sinew of the hip. Now, couple things I see going on here, and we call this thing discovering God's will for a reason, because I think all of us should be in that process of searching for God's will for our own personal lives, but also watching in terms of God's will for people's lives around us as well. There's a couple things I see going on here, and I'm going to have to break this down. First off, this is a midlife crisis, or you could just call it a crisis here for Jacob. As I said, if you take his age and you work our kind of age into this, he's in his midlife. You know, that's someplace between 35 and 50 for us, unless you're going to be living to 110, then it might be more. But basically, this is a midlife crisis for Jacob at this point in time. He's done all the work for his family. He's got all these kids. He's got these four women he's got to take care of. But he's got a huge business going on. And he's also encountering the demons of his past, of his childhood. There's a midlife crisis going on. That's the first thing. And the second thing that's going on here is God is about to change Jacob's identity. Okay? And this is a physical picture of a spiritual reality. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 11, it's Apostle Paul writing, and he says, all these stories in the Old Testament have been written down for our instruction on whom the end of the age has come. Basically, he's saying we can gain a lot of help in terms of our own lives by looking and reading and studying the lives of those in the Old Testament. And that's what we're doing here on this night. There's four things that we need to understand about what's going on here. First, this is a high-stress moment in terms of Jacob's life. I mean, high stress. This is life and death kind of thinking here. The second thing about this is that as far as Jacob is concerned, his world is possibly coming to an end. And if it's not coming to an end, it's at least changing radically. That's the second thing. The third thing about this is that Jacob has at least been talking to God, and God has been talking to him over the past 20 years, and there's been a sort of a communication that's been going on. I like to think of Jacob as just being a man who is born again. Basically, he believes in God, and he knows he's out there and all this, but he really hasn't taken that for himself as a relationship that he's supposed to live in. So he knows this. God said, but. God said he'd do this, but. I'm living this life, and it's my derriere that's on the block here. The fourth thing about this particular setup right here is he is literally seeing his life pass before him. And I mean all of his life, because you got to go back to him when he was growing up in that household with Esau and all, and how mom was for him and dad was for Esau and all that goes with that, and then also the trickery that took place and all that going on. So his life is passing before him. And remember this, Jacob has not read his story. He doesn't know how this turns out. And neither have you. You have not read your story. You may be very familiar with the Bible and all that goes with it in terms of that, or you may not. But you haven't. You don't know the end of your story. Neither does Jacob. And that's why when we're talking about discovering God's will here, we can look at Jacob and what he does and all the people around him and all that stuff and how God is working in the midst of this entire life thing. And this is the place in Jacob's life where everything is coming to a head. And if you're going to write things down, write this down. In moments like these, that's when God shapes us. It's in moments like these that God shapes us. And the definition of crisis is that's when things are out of your control. It is no longer in your hands. And if you talk about a crisis in a family or a crisis in a community or a crisis in a nation or something like that, the definition is when things are out of your control, period. It's no longer in his hands. And that's where we find Jacob tonight. And this is when he's going to have his name changed. And verse 24, those five words are so filled with energy as far, and Jacob was left alone. He didn't have Rachel beside him. He didn't have Leah beside him. He didn't have his workers beside him. He didn't have his business partners beside him. He didn't have anybody beside him. He was all alone. And so we're going to be looking at four things here. And you might want to flip this. I don't know where I am in terms of the outline. But four things that are happening. He is wrestling that I want to talk about. Are you wrestling with God or are you wrestling with man? That's the first one. Second one is, what's in a name? Since he's going to have his name changed here, what's in a name? The third thing is the midlife stuff that is going on with him at this point in time. And there is such a thing as midlife crisis, and it's real. And if you're between the ages of 35 and 50, then you can know that it's real stuff. And the fourth thing is when God changes your name. His name was Jacob, which means supplanter or one who overthrows. That's what it meant. He was a wrestler. Like it's a wrestler. His name is going to be changed to Israel, which is one who rules with God or Prince of God. Okay? Now, what we have here taking place, and this is a little bit of, is either a theophany or a Christophany. That's when God makes an appearance. A theophany is when God makes an appearance in the Old Testament. A Christophany is if Jesus were making the appearance in the Old Testament. And actually, I think it could be either one. You know, it could be Jesus or it could be God or whatever. And there's an appearance of God in human form. When Joshua was before Jericho, God appeared to him, or Jesus did. We're not sure, but they have an encounter there. And God appears in human form. That's a Christophany or a theophany. When he became a man and dwelt among us, that was not making an appearance. That's when he came to live with us. So the second thing about this is it God here or is it a man? I mean, that's something we all have to think about. And you have to think about, too, you know, most of us live our lives just horizontally. One way, I mean, just the human way. But if you think about it vertically, you know, is this God that he's wrestling with or is this man that he's wrestling with? When my kids were growing up, and I was a young man in middle age, we used to have a game that we'd play. You know, the original Superman with, what was the Reeves guy name? Christopher Reeves. Well, we bought the soundtrack to that, and we would play Monster. And in the game, I would wrestle with my kids. And they were ages basically 2 to 12. I didn't usually wrestle with all of them at the same time, but we would put on Superman, the theme, and they would be superheroes. You know, Wonder Woman and Superman, and sometimes it was Spectre Man. That's a Japanese dude. And, they would just pick him out, and I would be the monster. And we would wrestle to Superman. And we did that for, years. It really got kind of testy when my eldest was 12 years old because that kind of got hard on good old dad. Now, I would let them wrestle with me, and they would beat the monster, you know, and we would do this thing. But the thing that I know about that time is that whenever we played Monster, the truth is I could have beaten every one of them anytime, except maybe the 12-year-old, as I got older anyway. But we would play that game. And I always think about this wrestling match that Jacob has here at the Jabbok River, you know, because it says that he just touched him, and boom, out went his hip. And I think about that. Is he wrestling with God or is he wrestling with man at that point in time? The other thing is that the crisis of his earlier life is raising its ugly head at this point. He has demons in his past. You know, I did a sermon back in December called The Hopes and Fears of All the Years. It was that basically that Blue Christmas era that we were looking at. But, you know, I know that families come together at Christmas time, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and a lot of times we have old demons, don't we? That are inhabit those encounters with our family, where the hopes and fears of all the years kind of come together. And so there's this happening here at this contest, this wrestling contest on the River Jabbok. Is it man or is it God? And the other thing about this, it says they did this all night long. I've taken enough tours in people's lives and lived my own. Have you ever lain awake at night and you've been striving with God, or you're striving with God about your life, or you're just stewing in your own juices about your life and how it's been going and what's going on in terms of your life? They wrestled all night long. And I've known people, you know, where you just lay awake and you're dealing with the stuff of your life. What do I do with all that? And are you wrestling really with God, or are you wrestling with humanity or your world? And at the end of this, God hurts him. And I know this. At least when it comes to Christian leaders, I know this, that if you're going to be a Christian leader and God is going to shape you in terms of your leadership abilities, it's like the potter and the clay. We read that, and we always take it to heart. It's in Jeremiah someplace. He is the potter, we are the clay. Well, I'm going to tell you about this clay, that when he gets to messing with my clay, it hurts. Now, I don't know about you folks, but I don't like it a lot of times when he's deciding, well, I got to reshape Jack in certain areas here because, and it hurts, doesn't it? And you might say, well, I'm wrestling with God in terms of that kind of stuff. But one of the things I know is that if God is going to use you in terms of your life, and you might be the redemption for somebody in your family or your workplace or something like that, if he's going to use you, he's going to hurt you at some point in time to get your attention and bring things into place that need to be in place in terms of your life so that you can be the man or the woman you're supposed to be. And he is the potter, we are the clay, but the clay screams sometimes at that. And I think about that in terms of this wrestling match by the river Jabbok. And it's like me when I played Monster with my kids. At any point in time, I could take them out. And I knew it. Now, if you think about your own life here, because part of what we're doing here, we're looking at Jacob's story, but we're looking at discovering God's will for our own life as well. And when have you been wrestling with God, or are you doing it right now in terms of your life, in terms of the direction of your life, in terms of the purpose of your life, in terms of your identity as a person, in terms of what that means in terms of this world? You think about this. We think we live these lives horizontally, and we have these battles that we have in our lives. And a lot of times we just think of them as horizontally, and we're dealing with people and everything. But I want you to think vertically for a moment. Are you wrestling with man, or are you wrestling with God about your life, your purpose, your direction, your identity? I know this. People struggle with life, period. We all do. Is there any purpose to it? Anyway, do you look up? Do you think about it vertically in terms of your life? Do you think about it in terms of how God is really trying to shape you when you're in difficult places and things are really hurting a little bit in terms of your life? You know, if God is in your life, then you need to think about it. The vertical sense is, am I really wrestling with God, or am I really wrestling with my situation and man, or you know? I know this truth too. If you want to be God's man or woman in this world, that is, if you want to be his disciple, and he said it, you must die to self. And you know, if you think about that, you must die. And that means, well, to be born again, you need to die. happened. Where are you in your life right now? See, this is not just about the Bible study story of Jacob wrestling with this man or God or whatever. It's also about yours. And I may just be the voice talking to you. I may be the messenger, and God's bringing this stuff to your attention. Is this circumstance, event, situation, who or what I'm striving with in reality? Is it really the world around me, man, or is it God? What's the horizontal implications? What's the vertical implications of it? Matthew chapter 10, verses 32 to 39. This is Jesus talking here, by the way. And, oh, you know, we always think of Jesus as meek and mild, such a nice guy, and all that. And I'm here to tell you, when God is moving in your life, he's not always just that Mr. Nice Guy to you. Verses 32 to 39. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven. Those are not nice words, by the way. If you think they are, I don't know who you are reading. Do not think that I've come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. This isn't gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Baby Jesus in the crib, right? For I've come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Well, I can understand that. And a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. These are not nice words, folks. And he who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. And he who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake we'll find it. I'm going to tell you about the confrontations of God in our lives. And you need to understand this truth. And this can be a truth also in terms of churches, by the way. When God moves, it causes people to wonder. And you might be able to put your own name in here. It causes us to wonder because he gets confrontational with us. We always talk about the grace of God and all that stuff, and that's really good and that's really true. But when God gets confrontational and says, listen, we're going someplace and you need to be shaped. When he gets intense with us or he appears to be, I thought he was my friend, and he becomes different. And he gets in your face. And I don't know if you've ever had God do this to you. It's kind of like when your friend comes up to you, and he takes his finger, and he pokes it right in your chest right here and says, listen, we need to talk because things are going to change around here. That's the way God is at times. And that is not meek and mild Jesus. That's not what a friend we have in Jesus. Christ Almighty, what a pal. That's my version of the song. God has always confronted people to build them. And that you are not the exception to that rule. If you're going to be God's man or woman in this world, if you're going to take on a role of Christian leadership or discipleship, he will confront you at places that you need to be reshaped. When Moses was going down to Egypt to free all the slaves in Egypt, do you know that halfway down there, God appeared to him? It was a Christophany or a theophany. And he said, you're not going any farther till you circumcise your kids. I'm going to kill you right here. Look it up. It's in the Bible. You don't ever see that in the Ten Commandments, but that's the truth. He says, you're not going any farther, Moses, until you get your house in order. period. When Joshua was at Gilgal and they're getting ready to go into the promised land, things were changing for the entire nation, and they were moving from being, well, taken care of by God to they were going to have to fulfill their rulership and dominion in terms of the promised land. They get across that river, and the first thing they do is they stop and they circumcise all the men. Well, I don't know about you, but if I'm one of those guys, I'm going, what? He says, you're not going any farther till you get back in covenant with me. That's what he said to Moses. That's what he said to Joshua and all the boys as they crossed the river. And then I talked about Joshua at Jericho, and he says, are you with me? Are you a friend or a foe? Are you with me or not? And God says, no. Whoa, what is this? You know, confrontation. We talked about Jacob 20 years earlier, really when he met God for the first time. I have always encountered, thought that that's kind of like being born again. You know, that's when you get baptized in church and you say you're going to be God's man or woman, or and that is. But nothing seems to happen. And for 20 years, God may have talked to you in little ways in the here and there. But suddenly, we've come to a different point in his life, and there's a confrontation that takes place. And no longer are you just going to be born again and make it into heaven. You're going to be my man or woman in this world. And I'm going to deal with you at this point. And we all have struggles with the world, don't we? There's struggles with the world. There's struggles with other people in our lives. God, if it weren't for people, my ministry would be great. And the third thing is we can struggle with ourselves. I don't know how many times. Have you laid awake at night just struggling, stewing in your own juices? I'm going to tell you this. You can write this down. There is something about the time just prior to a move of God. There's something about the time just prior to a move of God. It's a change in the weather. You might say, the wind starts to blow differently. Something happens. So let me ask you, are you struggling right now? This is about discovering God's will, by the way. And are you wrestling with anything right now? Or have you been? It could be. Oh, this looks so horizontal. It could be your finances. It could be your job. It could be your health. It could be family troubles. You know, there's just problems in the house. And it could be relatives. It could be a habit you're dealing with. You're trying to get out of that habit. It could be your spiritual life. Are you going to grow or not? Or, you know, am I going to be God's man or woman or not? You know, it might be your marriage. It might be about over future obedience and commitment to God. What are you wrestling with? Is it God or is it man? You know, is it God or is it this world you're dealing with? And Jacob was left alone. And I don't know how many times I could put my own name in. And Jack was left alone to deal with his life. Now, a principle here. If you are wrestling with God, or if you're wrestling with things, don't give up until God blesses you. It's a truth. If you are wrestling with God, don't give up until God blesses you. I know this truth. When I lose to God, I have always won. As simple as that. And I don't know how to put it, but you know, if you don't go through the battle, you don't know that you've lost or won. In that Matthew passage right here, in Matthew chapter 10, verse 39, he says, he who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it. And that's what was going on here. Now, my job as pastor of this church, and I will say that too, as pastor of this church, but also the speaker of the night here, my job is to bring the teaching. Because I'm a teaching elder. And I know that. And it may be that my bringing the teaching, I may have to be the vehicle or the messenger or the voice to bring the word to you that the wrestling is going to get intense. Because he was bringing Jacob to a focused moment here in his life. This is different than being born again, that we do this in church. You know, if someone is, we cheer people who are baptized and born again and they confess Jesus as their Savior and all that. But this is different. Because, in fact, I think that Jacob really did that 20 years ago. He says, and you know, if you remember what he said, he said, okay, if you do these things, then maybe I'll be your man. And we'd play that game with him too. You know? And so wrestling with God, it may look, when you're in terms of your life, it might look very human. It very easily could. But he was moving him from a somewhat diffuse and abstract identity in terms of who God was in his life to a more consolidated and structured identity of who he was. You might call this a rite of passage, too, for him in terms of moving from acknowledging his father's God and acknowledging his grandfather's God to saying, oh, you want to have a relationship with me in reality, and you want me to walk where you want me to walk as disciple. It's also a time where you come to be to die. Now, death can be very symbolic or psychological or spiritual or physical. But it has to do with the old ways of doing things. You know, he's been doing things his way for half his life. Well, all his life. But it's just half of his life. The old ways of thinking, the old ways of feeling, but you got to die to that for the new person to emerge. And so we're looking at this in terms of four things that we're going to be looking at. But who are you wrestling with? Are you wrestling with God? Or are you wrestling with man in terms of your life? Who is really challenging you in reality? Okay, I got time. The second part of this is what's in a name. He changes his name here. You know, and in reality, we don't think much about God changes Jacob's name. Why does he do that? Have you ever asked? I mean, do you think about this stuff? Why did he change his name? Well, I guess I'm supposed to give you the answers. God changes his name because he's changing his identity, for one thing. Why did Saul, when he got talked to by Jesus, taken out to the woodshed, and talked to by Jesus, got knocked off that horse and blinded for 3 days when he says, why are you persecuting me? And knocked Saul right off that horse, and then he changed his name to Paul. Why did he do that? When Jesus was talking to Simon, and he met Simon, and he says, you know, you're Simon now, but later on, you're going to be Peter. And basically, why did he change his name? Because he was changing his identity. You know, today we have a mixed attitude about names. We really do have mixed attitudes. I mean, we name people of whatever. You know, to the phone company, I've got one number. I'm a number. I'm not a name. In reality, I don't care if they put your name on the envelope or whatever. You're still a number. You know that, don't you? You're not totally stupid, are you? That they tell you that you mean something, but you're nothing but a number. According to the government, Oh, we care about all of you. And it comes from both Democrats and Republicans. Oh, we care about you and we love you, but you're nothing but a number. And it has 9 letters in it, numbers. To my credit card company, what am I? I am nothing but a number. So we have a mixed attitude about, well, what is their name? To my bank, I'm nothing but a number. Are you anything better than that? I don't care how much money you got in your account. You're nothing but a number. And the world system gives us a number and takes away our identity. Do you know that? The world steals your name and gives you a number. In the story of Daniel, they took their names, the Hebrew names that they had, and they changed their names to fit their society. That is exactly what happens with all of us. So what's in a name? When God is doing this stuff, you need to think about this. By the way, God writes your name on the palm of his hand. And you know that song? And you could, this is a principle, by the way. You are nobody till somebody loves you. You know that? You're nobody till somebody loves you. And thank God, God loves us. So we become somebody. God loves you also by name, not by number. The world says names aren't important because in reality, and this is the truth, and you need to know the truth because it'll set you free in terms of how the world lives. In the world, you are not a person. Individuals are not important. You are not important. But God says people are important. And there are two poles that we live in, between two poles. And we fall between these poles. Oh, I could make a bear joke at this point, but I won't. You all know it. By the way, I will bring this up. Parky is a sinner par excellence because one of the definitions of sin is to miss the mark. And buddy, he missed the mark. Anyway, we fall between two poles as to what is in a name that we have. One mother named her child her Alpha and Omega. That was the first and second name because that was the first and last child she was ever going to have. Alpha Omega. That's true. I had a friend, he wasn't a friend, I knew him. I went to high school with this kid. His first name was Regis. His middle name was Padoff. And we got to thinking about, what a strange name. I can't remember what his last name was. And we figured it out. When his mother had this guy, she must have looked on one of the machines that was right around it, and it said, RE Registered U.S. Patent Office. And she named him Regis Padoff. True story. I went to school with a guy. And names. So names are kind of state. Also, there's some other things about names. Names are can be very, we have superstitious thinking about this, but I think there's also some truth to this. There is an essence of power in a name. A name is related to fame or renown or memory or memorial or remembrance. All these things fall together in the context of what a name is in terms of that. In the Hebrew, it means to be high up. That's what it means. A name is to be high. In other words, it's kind of like a monument. And so when you get a name, you are being raised up by that particular name. So a name is if you have a monument someplace, something happened there. That's what you have in a monument. And so one of the things about the Old Testament is when you read the names, it's good to look up in a concordance, what is the meaning of that name? Because a lot of these things have real meaning that go along with what's going on in terms of the story. Like Gilgal, where they were circumcised, that's the rolling away of reproach. That's the shame that they had as a people being slaves was rolled away at that point when they came back into covenant. You know, names have to do with your existence. You know, there's a talk about demonic life. If you know their name, you can actually cast them out in terms of that, because names have power. My dad used to say when I was in high school, and I know what he says, he said, now listen, you're going out tonight now, Jack. He said, just remember, you're taking my name with you. Don't disgrace it. And there's some truth to that. You know, I take his name with me wherever I go. Name has to do with your existence. Why did Adam name the animals in the Old Testament, you know, in Genesis? And Adam named, and he says, oh, that one's going to be a rhinoceros. And Eve says, well, why'd you name it rhinoceros? He says, it's the only one that looked like one. Rhinoceros, you know, why? It's the only one that looked like a rhino. Names have to do with personality. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 26. Let me find it. I didn't mark it, so I have to look it up. 40:26. Lift up your eyes on high and see who created these. He who brings out their host by number, calling them by name. In other words, in terms of God bringing people out and a whole host of people like an army, he brings them out by numbers, but he calls them by name. God knows your name. God gives you your name. It has to do, names have to do with personalities as well. In 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 25, Abigail and David are talking, and they're talking about Abigail's husband, who's a real idiot. His name's Nabal, and it means fool. His mother must have known something. And he does foolish things, and it gets him killed. But his name means fool. We name teams. How am I doing? We name teams. Oh, gosh. We have Bears, and we have Bengals, and we have Eagles, and we have Giants. But you don't see any chipmunks out there. We have cars like Impala and Mustang and Cobra and Firebird, but you don't see any skunks riding down the road. I'm convinced that one of the reasons that the Cubs took 100 years to win the World Series was because they were named Cubs. That's a small version of the real thing in terms of that thing. Now, this true story. I lived in Western Kentucky. I lived in Madisonville, Kentucky. And did you go to high school down there? No, you were in Springfield, right? North Hopkins High School in Madisonville, Kentucky has as their, what is their name? They call them the what? The Maroons. What are Maroons? They're not Eagles. They're not Impalas. They called them Maroons. So I looked it up by truth. I looked it up in the dictionary. Besides being a color, it means abandoned, forsaken, cast off, left behind, or cut off. And I says, they really ought to change what they call themselves. Abandoned, forsaken, cut off. They better stick with the color. That's all I got to say. It's a bad self-image. You know, it's kind of like the New Hope Baptist Church. Is it New Hope? No Hope. The No Hope Baptist Church in No Hope, Kentucky. I think I would change the name of that church. The No Hope Baptist Church. Jacob here means supplanter or overthrower in terms of that. Because he struggles with man and God, and he's always working the wrestling match. In the Old Testament, Naomi means bitterness. I had a couple of girls down in Kentucky whose names were Leah. We don't have any Leahs here or in this church, so that's good, because Leah means wild cow. And I anybody sit at the table of Leah on a great banquet? Oh, there you go. That your table name is Wild Cow, by the way, just so you know. You've heard of Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman and all that. Well, Ichabod is the joining of two words. The Kabod is the word for glory. And Ich, at the front end of it, is loss. So Ichabod's name in the Old Testament was the loss of glory. Well, in Ichabod Crane, that's what he's named. Abram, we've done the study on Abraham. Abram started by the name of Abram, and God changed his name from Abram to Abraham. And he changed Sarai to Sarah. And both of them have a breath sound in them that they didn't have before. And it was like God was putting his spirit into their name. And he changed a little bit of the meaning of the name, but not a lot of it. But what he did was he put his spirit into their name, Abraham and Sarah. And that sound was in there because the word for spirit is ruach in the Hebrew. So there's something about names that we need to understand in terms of this. My name, by the way, for those who care, means God's gracious gift, which aren't you glad? But my nickname is Jack, which comes from the French word Jacques, which comes from the word Jacob, so I'm one who overthrows. So you figure it out. I'm God's gracious gift who overthrows a lot of things that we do. Now, your name is you. Despise a name, and you despise a person. You need to understand that. So we're looking at this, and this is obviously a two-parter here, but we're wrestling with God and man, and it's when God is changing Jacob's name to Israel. What does your name mean? The other thing is that we used to be Woodland Chapel. We moved from over there on Lost Bridge Road. We were Woodland Chapel. What do you think of when you think of Woodland Chapel? I think of a small sanctuary kind of place, church body, in the woods, don't you? I mean, that's what I think of. It is not a full-blown church. It is more like for small venues, you might say, in terms of the Christian faith. We moved from there over here. And for a year, some of these things still say Woodland Chapel on them. We were Woodland Chapel. And I raised it up to you at that point in time and says, hey, we're no longer in the woods. And this is no longer a small venue church. We're a Woodless Chapel then. And so we had to change the name. Moses at the burning bush talks to God, and God tells him at that point in time his name, which is Yahweh, which they didn't put the vowels in. It's YHWH, which means I cause to be, basically. We think of it as I am, but it's I cause to be. I am the one who causes everything to be, and that is my name. And Moses was sent down to Egypt in the authority of God's name, Yahweh, because nobody knew it except for him. Jesus was crucified because he claimed to be God. His name is Joshua, Yeshua in Hebrew, which is the same as the Joshua in the Old Testament. And the reason they crucified him is because he said, I am God. Not because he was just a troublemaker. He said, I am God. Yeshua saves is what his name means. Yahweh saves. And so that's why it's the name of Jesus. When Peter, John, and his brother James were at the Gate Beautiful, and this guy says, give me something, give me money, if, praying for alms. He says, Peter says, I'll give you what I've got. In the name of Jesus, rise up and walk. And the guy was healed on the spot. And what did he do? He used the name. And so we're about to encounter not only in this wrestling match in terms of his midlife crisis and all that's going on with him, we're going to see a man who is being changed from the inside out because his identity is about to be changed because he's going to have a new name. Jacob has been the picture of his life up to this point. A man who supplants or wrestles with the things of life and God and man and doesn't quit, but he keeps working at it. But his name, identity is going to be changed to, and his purpose and his direction. You are now a prince of God. You are one who rules with God. That's what the name means. So we're going to stop here. And I submit all of this to you in Jesus' name. Let's pray. Lord, I ask that you would take